From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
We've been hearing a lot about attacks on Nigeria's oil pipelines over the past year, but not much about MEND, the group that's claimed responsibility for the attacks. For this edition of Backstory, we've invited Sebastian Younger to explain MEND's objectives and the potential impact of their activities on American oil supplies. Blood Oil, his article on the subject, appears in the February issue of Vanity Fair, where Mr. Younger is a contributing editor, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hi there.
So when did MEND first come onto the scene?
Well, the militancy, as it's known, has been active in the Niger Delta for years. But MEND itself, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, sort of burst onto the scene in last January, just about a year ago.
The Emancipation of the Niger Delta. So does that mean this is a separatist group?
Well, strictly speaking, no. They've never said that they wanted their own country or political autonomy. What they do want, at least what they claim to want, is control over their resources, and those resources primarily being the oil, the immense oil reserves under the Niger Delta, and also some degree of affiliation with the government. There's virtually no social services in the Niger Delta, and I think part of their idea of emancipation is basically that part of the country be sort of brought up to speed with drinking water and sanitation and all those things.
Who are members of MEND? Is there obviously these are local people, but is this a group that grows out of other militant groups, or is this something that just grows out of the problems of the area?
Well, both. Just a quick background on the area. There are hundreds of billions of dollars of oil reserves under the Niger Delta, and their reserves have been tapped by multinational oil companies in collaboration with the Nigerian government. And very, very briefly, 60, 70, even 80% of the profits of the oil go to the Nigerian government, and the rest is profit by companies like Shell. The oil is drilled in the Niger Delta, and there are a lot of environmental problems because of it. The local industry is fishing, and the fish stocks have really been killed off, and partly because of oil spills. And so there's always been, for the past 10 or 15 years, there's been unrest in the Niger Delta. Basically, the locals there get all the downside of the oil industry without any of the upside. The Nigerian government is so incredibly corrupt that none of the billions of dollars that flow to the government from the oil companies actually get back to the creeks and the small towns of the Delta. So there have been criminal gangs, political gangs for years that have kidnapped oil workers and sold them back to the oil companies, that have tapped oil out of the pipelines illegally. It's called bunkering oil, stealing oil, and then selling it. That's been going on for years. MEND, actually, as far as I can tell, now I'm an outsider, but from my eyes, from my viewpoint, MEND seems to be the sort of least criminal and the most political of all these groups. They're quite principled. They've taken many hostages, but have never hurt any hostages. They are now saying that they are holding hostages right now. They do not want money for them. They want political concessions. They sort of have moved out of the realm of, I think, what you could call a criminal enterprise.
So what do they want most? Do they want changes that would protect the environment and allow for the return of fishing, or do they want a piece of the action as far as the oil money is concerned?
Well, the way they articulate their desires sort of depends on who you're talking to. You often, if you're in the Delta, you often hear, we want control of our resources. That kind of thing, a sort of general truth about the political situation there. But specifically, their specific demands, as articulated by email from their spokesman, a guy named Jomo, the demands include $1.5 billion in restitution for environmental damage. That echoes a Nigerian court decision which stated that Shell had to pay that much money to clean up environmental damage in the Delta. MEND wants Shell to make good on that court judgment. They want the release of two Ijaw leaders. The Ijaw are a tribal group in the Niger Delta. MEND is primarily Ijaw, and they want the release of two Ijaw leaders who have been imprisoned by the Nigerian government. And they want, in a general sense, they want benefit from the oil industry. The Nigerian government makes about $1 billion a week in revenue from the oil industry in Nigeria, and they want a piece of that. I think the piece is partly negotiable, but they certainly want a piece of it.
And Nigerian oil is highly prized, isn't it?
It is. I'm not a petrochemist, but it's termed light sweet crude, and the result of that is that it needs very little refining before it can be put in your car and used. It's been said, I don't know if this is true, but the word in the Niger Delta is you could practically pump it out of the ground into your car and drive away. I don't know if that's quite true, but it's a very, very pure form of oil. I believe there's very little sulfur in it, and so that makes it particularly valuable in the world market and particularly valuable to the United States.
My guest is Sebastian Younger, whose latest article for Vanity Fair, where he is a contributing editor, is Blood Oil, on the subject of MEND and Nigeria's oil situation. You describe Nigeria as being a victim of the resource curse. What does that mean?
Well, generally, the resource curse is understood to be this strange paradox, particularly in Africa. Countries that are, quote, blessed with natural resources, diamonds, minerals, oil, almost invariably are countries that are racked by civil war and corruption and ultimately are underdeveloped. What happens is when you have such an easy source of revenue, it's tempting for an African country to not develop education, to not develop other infrastructure, and in fact, for the government to become an incredibly corrupt enterprise. And of course, that keeps the country in question in a perpetual state of underdevelopment, and often that leads to civil war. So what you see in countries like Liberia, Sierra Leone, Angola, Nigeria, is incredible poverty and chaos, despite the fact that they are sitting on incredibly valuable natural resources. That's what's known as the resource curse, and Nigeria is probably the preeminent example of that.
But this also applies to other, in fact, most oil-producing countries, because the per capita GNP of OPEC countries has gone into steady decline over the past 30 years, and in non-oil-producing countries, it has steadily risen.
That's right. I mean, if you have oil, it's such an obvious and easy source of revenue, you don't develop all kinds of other quieter industries. I mean, by quieter, I mean industries that maybe don't pay off quite as well immediately, that are less attention-getting, but ultimately, in the long term, over decades, could really sustain the country quite well. Those do not get developed. And so as these countries progress, what happens is the oil industry is subject to the vagaries of the world market, and something quite stable like an agricultural base does not get developed, and ultimately it is quite bad for the country.
Well, how is the oil revenue supposed to be divvied up in Nigeria? Are there any laws in place?
Well, it's extremely complicated, but the basis of it that I understood was multinational companies like Shell, they have a contract with the Nigerian government that allows them to drill for oil in partnership with a Nigerian oil company, and they divide up the barrel of oil according to a percentage. Typically, the Nigerian government gets at least 60 and as much as 90% of the revenue generated by the drilling of oil in the Niger Delta for each oil company.
Now, of course, when we say 60 to 90%, we're saying in theory that money then goes back into the economy. Is it in fact the case that it pretty much goes into the pockets of the people who are ruling the country?
Well, that seems to be the case. Nigeria is infamously corrupt. It's been estimated that in the past several decades that Nigerian government officials have stolen or misspent something like $400 billion, which rivals the total amount of Western aid to all of Africa in that time.
And the corruption hasn't been confined to the Nigerian side. I've heard that Kellogg, Brown, and Root admitted to paying the Nigerian government $2.4 million in bribe. This is the Halliburton people. And the oil companies are supposedly paying off the government as well in bribes on top of the oil earnings. And then there's the case of Nigeria and Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson. The $90,000 found in his freezer by the FBI was reportedly from Nigeria's Vice President Atiku Abubakar.
That's right. The examples of corruption in Nigeria are so pervasive. They're so staggering. They're so overwhelming. As a journalist, you tend to sort of get captivated by that. But then I realized corruption begets corruption everywhere. And exactly as you say, there are American businesses and apparently possibly even a congressman who have participated in the corruption. There is so much money involved in the oil business in Nigeria. As I said, $1 billion a week goes to the Nigerian government. So with that kind of money floating around, it's very, very tempting for, say, a $100 million bribe. You can divert or you can set up a business deal in Nigeria. It's with that kind of money floating around, a $100 million bribe is actually not particularly a lot of money. I think it's inevitable in a situation with that kind of cash.
Does the oil industry at least employ a lot of Nigerians?
It does employ a lot of Nigerians. There are at Port Harcourt, there's a university which teaches oil engineering. There are people who pass through that through the university with degrees as petrochemical engineers and so on. But there are more people who want jobs than there are jobs. And one of the ironies of the whole business is that the militant groups who want to tap oil out of the pipelines that are in the Delta, they literally go to the oil pipelines, tap holes in them, put a hose in it, and pump oil out of the pipelines into barges, and then sell those barges full of oil basically into the international market. That is a very tricky and dangerous job, and it's best done by someone who has been trained, properly trained at a university. So what they will do is the militant groups will scoop up graduates of the oil programs at the universities, guys who cannot get jobs with the oil companies, and they will hire them to help illegally tap into the pipelines so that oil can be stolen. It's estimated that something like 10% of the oil that comes out of Nigeria onto the world market is actually bunkered oil. It's actually stolen oil, stolen in the creeks by guys in speedboats.
Well, why would the companies even care if they're paying bribes in such high amounts? Don't they make enough profit from the pipelines to offset the loss they have from this bunkering?
Well, that's the thing. It becomes a kind of tax. It becomes a kind of additional tax, and there's so much money getting pumped out of there that in some ways it's just a price that's paid for doing business in Nigeria. I think what's going to happen, one thing that the oil companies really could not withstand would be large-scale acts of sabotage to the infrastructure. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars to build an oil rig. The LNG facility off the coast of Nigeria at Bonny Island, I think it costs billions of dollars to put together. If facilities like that are attacked and destroyed by men, at that point, I think Shell and other companies will be forced to pull out of the Niger Delta and possibly suspend operations.
Is that a possibility? In the past, Shell, if I remember correctly, could call on the Nigerian military to come in and fight a battle for it.
That's right. The Nigerian military, first of all, they're not particularly well trained or well armed. The MEND militants that I met with were incredibly well armed, very, very, very good weapons, much better than the Nigerian military that I saw. And also, they're corrupt. I mean, it's a country awash in oil money, and the soldiers and officers in the Nigerian Navy, the Nigerian Army, are not very well paid. They're paid, I'm not sure what, $100 a month, something like that. So it's very easy for these militant groups to come in and say, here's $10,000, now go away. Or even better, here's $10,000, can you guard our shipment of bunkered oil to make sure no other militant groups kidnap it? Can you guard it offshore until we can offload it into a tanker? And that works. So the Nigerian military is sort of playing both sides of the game here. And I think there are weapons that could take out the LNG facility at Bonny Island without a major naval battle. I think there are shoulder-fired rockets that could do tremendous damage. And I'm not sure the Nigerian military could do much about that. I don't know if MEND has those weapons, but if they do, I would consider that a legitimate threat to the facility.
Sebastian Younger's article, Blood Oil, is featured in the February issue of Vanity Fair. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Sebastian Younger, whose latest piece for Vanity Fair is called Blood Oil, based on reporting there. Now, how long did you spend in Nigeria?
I was there for about 2 weeks, almost all of it in the Niger Delta.
And did you have an opportunity to meet people from MEND?
I did, twice. MEND typically, up until now, has refused any journalists access to their organization in the creeks. Now, by the creeks, I mean the network of within the Niger Delta of mangrove swamps and small passageways that can only be navigated by small boats.
But don't groups of this sort usually welcome support from the media? And that's the way they get their story told.
That's true, but MEND so far has, I mean, many, many journalists have gone to the Niger Delta, asked for permission to meet with MEND, to photograph them, to interview them, and were denied by their spokesman, a man named Jomo, who is only available online. No one knows who he is, where he is, what his real name is.
It's rumored he lives in South Africa, isn't it?
There's some indication he might live in South Africa. But there seems to be a very good chain of command, and that the MEND fighters themselves do obey what Jomo says, and Jomo does seem to speak for them. So journalists who go to the Niger Delta, the first thing they do, as we did, was email Jomo. Invariably, Jomo says, no, you cannot meet with MEND. What we did, rather stupidly, was go off into the creeks anyway. We thought we knew someone else who had connections with MEND, and this guy promised to call ahead and alert them that we were coming and to welcome us. Well, none of that worked, and what happened was we went to this village, and MEND basically descended on us in their speedboats with machine guns, and they were very, very intimidating, aggressive-looking guys. They thought we were spies. And we were held there. We were effectively taken hostage for some hours until Jomo sorted all this out and ordered his guys to release us. Once he realized that we really were journalists, that we were the guys who had emailed them 3 days earlier, he ordered his men to release us. We went back. I continued an email dialogue with Jomo, eventually convinced him that there was some good in allowing us to meet his fighters. And we were the first journalists ever allowed into a MEND camp. We took photos and video, and I interviewed the field commander, a guy who called himself Brutus. It was a very intense, and I have to say, quite a frightening experience.
And you were told initially that they were going to kill you, so you came a long way. and also realized that even though they're rather secretive, they have some pretty good communications, because almost immediately you learned that your presence was known in South Africa and the United States.
Yes, we were in this village, a remote village in the creeks, thatch huts, no no clean drinking water, no nothing. I mean, it was a very primitive affair out there. And men descended on us, and there is some cell phone reception in the creeks. And word went out immediately to the Ijaw community, not only in the Delta, but all over the world. And apparently, we were told that there were Ijaw in the United States Googling our name to see if we were journalists or what we were. Likewise in South Africa, and that eventually it was confirmed that we were journalists. Maybe we were stupid, but we were journalists.
But you found out that you'd created a perfect storm.
Yeah, exactly. And but until they confirmed that, they thought we were spies, that we were possibly U.S. military intelligence. And one young man, very, very frightening, strong young guy with an enormous machine gun, walked up to me and poked me in the chest and said, "I'm going to kill you." And that was a bad moment. But ultimately, it's a very disciplined organization, it seems to be, and Jomo had us released. That's not always true of organizations like this. It does not always work that way.
Isn't it rumored that members of men can drink battery acid?
Well, it's not men, but it's interesting. The militancy in the Delta, all the different groups, they tap into a much older tradition of tribal warfare and the warrior cults of the various tribes, and particularly the Ijaw. There is a warrior god named Egbesu, and the guys who fight, the militants, one of the things they do is they sort of pay homage to Egbesu, which means they have to live their lives according to certain codes. They paint themselves with white paint. They adorn themselves with magical amulets. And in exchange for this process, for basically giving allegiance to Egbesu, in exchange for this, they are bulletproof. They can drink battery acid without harm. They're basically Superman. Now, whatever one might think about a belief like that, the fact is that it makes them incredibly brave in battle. And that bravery itself, I think, is very intimidating to the Nigerian military. So it almost has the same effect as if it were literally true. In firefights with the Nigerian military, often, it has been known to just basically drop their weapons and flee. And so this aura of invincibility is sort of reconfirmed simply because they have such bravado in battle.
Uh-huh. And so the Nigerian military is kind of terrified of them.
Often they are, yes. That's what I heard. I mean, I heard story again. It's hard for a journalist to confirm this, but several times I heard stories that that Ijaw fighters, men fighters, would walk up to unarmed Ijaw men would walk up to Nigerian soldiers and demand their rifle, and the Nigerian soldier who was armed would hand over his rifle simply because he was so scared of this Ijaw warrior.
Now, why is the Nigerian military so poorly trained? Didn't the United States conduct joint military exercises with them in 2004?
They did. But again, it's a very corrupt country, and corruption like that filters all the way through all aspects of society, including the military. So you have military officers who are in the Niger Delta fighting men and also facilitating the covert sale of weapons to men. It's incredible. You have a system like that, it's very, very hard to keep morale up in the army. They're very poorly paid. It's a conscript army, and essentially none of the Nigerian soldiers in the Delta want to be there or really particularly care about the problems there, and they certainly don't want to die fighting Ijaw militants who are fighting for what they feel is their birthright and their homeland.
Sebastian Younger is our guest on Backstory this month. We're talking about his article, Blood Oil, which is in the February issue of Vanity Fair. How much of the conflict in Nigeria is tribal? How much of it is religious? And how much of it is simply economic?
Well, it's a pretty toxic blend of all three. I mean, there is a religious conflict in Nigeria. It's roughly a north-south conflict. There's the north is Muslim.
The Hausa.
The Hausa, yes. And they dominate the government. The south is Christian. But within the Christian south, there are tribal groups that have at times been very, very at odds with each other to the point of real violence. And overlaying all of that is the tragic fact that Nigeria, with an enormous revenue from oil income, something like $50 billion a year, nevertheless is one of the very poorest countries in the world, because something like, I think the World Bank estimated that 1% of Nigerian society benefits from almost all of the oil revenue.
It's also the most populous country in Africa.
That's right. There are 130 million Nigerians. And because of the corruption at the top, everything downstream becomes corrupt. So right down to the traffic cops who demand bribes where they won't let you drive past them, the roads haven't been repaired in 20 years. So there are enormous potholes that caused horrific car accidents. The freeways are falling down. If you have a car accident in Nigeria, which is not an unlikely thing, you have to pay the police to even call an ambulance while you're bleeding from the side of the road. I mean, every aspect of society is basically a kind of controlled anarchy.
Despite the fact that Nigeria also has a highly educated populace, has produced some of the world's greatest writers, like Wole Soyinka. So this is an ironic situation. Does MEND have any connection to the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people, which challenged the Nigerian government in 1995?
Well, I think the Ogoni movement 10 years ago was sort of an inspiration for many of the other militant groups now. Ken Sarawiwa was an Ogoni leader, mm-hmm. who organized peaceful demonstrations against Shell because of the drilling in Ogoni land. Those demonstrations were violently suppressed by the Nigerian government. Hundreds of people were killed. And Ken Sarawiwa was eventually hanged, executed by the government under false pretenses. It was really an outrage of justice. And the result is that Shell can no longer drill oil in Ogoni land. It worked. I think other militant groups have drawn inspiration from the incredible idealism of Ken Sarawiwa. But again, unfortunately, there's so much money involved in all of this that a lot of these groups do criminalize, simply because to fund themselves, they need to engage in criminal enterprise, and then all of a sudden it becomes more about the money than about the idealism. Thus far, as far as I can tell, MEND has sort of stayed clear of that. I think they do have a sort of clear view of and rather untainted view of what they want to do politically. But it's hard to tell if that's really attainable.
In his State of the Union address in 2002, President Bush called the Nigerian pipelines a national strategic interest. So is the United States the primary market for Nigerian oil?
They are the fifth largest producer or supplier of oil to the United States. If Jomo's threats, if he makes good on his threats, which are to completely shut down Nigerian oil production, I've read analyses of that, of the effect of that on the U.S. and they're not very pretty. There's almost no margin in world oil production. Almost every drop of oil that gets pumped gets used. So if you disrupt supply like that, it has a tremendous effect all over the world. And in the U.S., it's estimated that oil would go to over $80 a gallon. I'm sorry, $80 a barrel.
Mm-hmm. It's at 55 right now, which is down from what it's been in recent months.
That's right. It would surpass the worst of the crisis from last year by about $10 a barrel. That would be very hard on our economy. The very dangerous thing about that, and that's why President Bush declared it to be a national strategic interest.
Well, what does that mean? Has the American government done anything in reaction to the instability in Nigeria?
Well, what it means legally is that we can intervene militarily in order to preserve our access to Nigerian oil. In other words, we could send Navy SEALs, American Special Forces, Marines into the Niger Delta to safeguard the oil infrastructure so that oil continues to flow to the United States. That's what that statement means. Whether we would do that or not is, we're deeply embroiled in Iraq and Afghanistan, of course. I'm not sure realistically we would want to take on another very, very, very messy political situation like Nigeria.
Men's last attack was on December 18th. They set off two explosions, two different oil facilities in the Delta. So if they're successful, what does that mean? The oil companies would leave, but this is oil that's incredibly valuable. Wouldn't somebody else just come in and try to either do it in a more strong-arm manner?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know what would happen exactly. The Chinese are right now at the bargaining table with the Nigerian government trying to set up deals for oil drilling. And the Iranians have just signed a deal with the Nigerian government to build offshore oil platforms. So,
well, both of those don't sound like things that President Bush would welcome.
No, they don't. I mean, I think the best solution would be for Shell and the other multinationals to pressure the Nigerian government to becoming more transparent and less corrupt. I mean, it wouldn't take much. I don't think it would take much in terms of providing social services to the very poor communities in the Niger Delta to really undermine the popular support for the militant groups. I mean, these little villages that I was in, there's no sanitation, there's no drinking water. I mean, they're drinking from the same river that they're defecating into. It's absolutely horrible. And meanwhile, half a mile away, you can see the oil wells. So I think if you improve the social conditions in the Niger Delta even a little bit, it would go a long way towards alleviating this crisis. The problem is if we don't, and by we I mean Western society, the oil companies, and the Nigerian government, if that does not happen, I think Jomo's threats are sincere. I think there will be a widening of the conflict in the Niger Delta, with maybe disastrous results to the global oil supply.
Well, the current political situation in Nigeria is better than it was in the past, and there's even some sense of democratic reforms, but not in this area? Is there just too much money going to some people on the top?
The Niger Delta itself, these little communities in the creeks where the oil is drilled, they are just they're indescribably poor. And on top of that, the fishing industry has collapsed because of pollution from the oil wells. So, yes, there is an election coming up in March. It promises to be quite contentious and violent. Nigeria is sort of wobbling towards something resembling democracy. I don't think any of that really has any real bearing on the situation in the Delta itself.
Sebastian Younger's article, Blood Oil, is in the February issue of Vanity Fair. Sebastian Younger is a contributing editor of Vanity Fair. And I want to thank you so much for participating in Backstory today. I guess we can only hope that Nigeria cleans up its act because this is such a valuable resource. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, a professor of sociology discusses the trend toward pre-programmed radio shows, empty television news stations, and copycat newspapers, then the influential life of Edith Gregor Halpert, who opened an art gallery in New York in 1926. Frank Warren talks about the secrets men and women reveal in anonymous postcards, plus Al and Larry Ubell, the gurus of how to answer your home repair questions. By the way, if you're looking for a good book or a great music recommendation, check out our guest picks page on WNYC.org and find out what inspires guests like Ellen Burstyn, Matt Dillon, James Carville, and Darlene Love. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neeschick. We had help today from Paula Crossfield. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.